Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Suquamish, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquamish people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, farmers need tools to ease the physical burden of their work and improve its efficiency. The earliest farmers, roughly 10,000 years ago, had simple hand tools, and much effort was required to plant, cultivate, and harvest food crops. Today, we have a plethora of more complex and ingenious self-labor-saving devices to help farmers accomplish more tasks in a less laborious fashion. Our guests today want to make it easier for farmers to find those tools. They also want to share ways to grow food that are kinder to Mother Earth, ways that build up the soil and increase the nutritional value of the food we eat. To accomplish this, they have formed an organization called FRIES, which, besides meaning a favored form of potato snack, now also means food resources, infrastructure, and education in the Shuswap. The purpose of FRIES is to help farmers access necessary tools and information to help them do the work of planting, growing, and harvesting food on healthy soil in order to enhance the health of their fellow citizens while increasing food security and food sovereignty. Our guests today are two couples, Jade and Isabel Shaman, and Kwok Nguyen and Amelia Jensen. They are the founding members of FRIES, Food Resources, Infrastructure, and Education in the Shuswap. A warm welcome to each one of you on Food Conversations.
Yeah, great.
Thank
Hello, thanks for welcoming us, Warren.
We have a crowd scene here today in the studio, and it's a wonderful thing to have. It's like
very happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, we're happy to have every single one of you, including Abel, Jade and Isabel's 5-year-old son,
yeah.
Who's eating a very healthy-looking apple, and we're very happy to have you here as well, Abel. Now, each of you has followed a remarkably different path to get to the work of FRIES. And I thought we could start with a little snapshot of what each of you have done prior to being at this point. Kwok, you have the longest path, both geographically and culturally.
Yeah.
A child in a farming family in war-torn Vietnam, came to Canada at age 6. Started out in Vernon, where you were welcomed, interestingly, by German refugees from World War II, which would meant there was some spiritual commonality between the two of you. And then you embarked on a career in finance and accounting. So out of that background, what is the essence of what brought you to be part of FRIES?
Yeah, thanks again for inviting us here. This is great to be having this conversation with each other. For myself, you know, my farming background, my grandfather was a rice farmer, and we always looked at that kind of work as being something that my parents wanted their kids to not do. They wanted them to have like an office job, right? To go to a shiny building.
Immigrants feel that way, of all cultures.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's interesting for me to have gone through that, worked in an office building that was shiny, that was made of glass. and you're so cut off from the environment in that world. You're cut off from fresh air, you're cut off from sunlight. And you're also cut off from the food that you eat. Because everything gets delivered or you go out for food. And it's not made by you, it's made by somebody else. It tends to be wrapped in a lot of plastics. And by the time you consume it, it's so different, the food that you're eating, what I ate in an office compared to what my grandfather was eating. And so we ended up on this food journey because, you know, I noticed, along with many other people, that my health was getting bad. You know, I didn't expect that to happen at such a young age. But I started to notice there were not just the aches and pains, but, you know, signs of rheumatoid arthritis that runs in my family. And I started to notice my hands were getting gnarled and these kinds of things. So it was kind of there in the background. And when you're so busy in the city that it's hard to take the time to stop and notice what's going on. And so we had a couple of inklings. I think like most people, the the big one was during the pandemic and the lockdowns. And we were in an apartment in Vancouver wondering, hey, how do we get food?
Without just walking to the corner store.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And now you said, I'm going to reverse that trend.
Yeah, so that's part of what we're trying to do here. So, you know, in the end, this is a bit of an experiment. For Amelia and myself, we are not seasoned farmers. We represent, like, you know, I think a lot of people who are trying to build a relationship again with their food.
Well, let's move to Isabel. Isabel, because you also have a little geographical displacement to be here in British Columbia. You were born and raised in rural Quebec in a military family, not people who are normally associated with food production, but they do eat. and you came out to BC for some tree planting activity, which is a common thing that a number of people from Quebec do. They come out here and then they moved on to fruit harvesting. And when you were in the Summerhill Winery, you met the gentleman who is now your husband, and the rest, as they say, is history. What for you is the reason for being part of this enterprise?
Yeah, I was not from a farming family. I don't foresee in my past that anybody grew anything. So it's very interesting, right? And so I was more of the wandering type of person. I traveled a lot, and, you know, being in military kid, you know,
you
we
to.
Traveled all the time, every year, like break your friend group and get a new one. So very used to adapting.
Social skills.
Yeah, huge. Like that was my focus. It's like, how do I get friends? How do I hear? I was never aware of food growing until I was wondering and noticing farms, noticing how people would live on a farm and how healthy it looked and how the family life was so rich. And when I met this one woman that grew all her vegetable for four kids for all year round, you know, eating, I was like, oh, she has something that I'm very interested in.
The light went on.
Yeah. Yeah. So since that, like, she still pops up in my mind sometimes and I'm like, oh yeah, her celery and her root cellar that were in, you know, moist sand. Think about that. So, so when I showed up at Summerhill and I saw there was this beautiful organic garden, and I was very attracted to it because there was this guy that seemed to know a lot about gardening. So I was like, I need to fish some information from this guy, you know, which I did. And we became friends for a while before we actually got together. Mm-hmm. And my journey with the farming right now. Jade's teaching me he has a lot of experience he'll be telling us about in a few minutes. And I keep learning every day. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a good way to live, learning every day.
Yeah.
Happens to me too. Amelia, you were raised on a hobby farm in Kelowna, and you did a lot of traveling as well, lots of different jobs. But then you trained as a dental hygienist. And for a number of years, you worked as a dental hygienist, and now you have a farm in Glen Eden. What was the inspiration for you to move into active participation in a group like Fry's?
Yeah, for me, it's always been about food.
Mm. I love food.
Yes.
I quoted you in
food.
My notes.
I love food, yes. Direct quote from Amelia Jensen. yeah, I love food both as a way to bring people together and to nourish your body, of course, as a mode of healing, body, mind. Yeah, so having been raised in that way, I was familiar with that lifestyle. And then, of course, lived in the city for years and years after that. And I just started to think back toward how that lifestyle really supports good health and how growing your own vegetables probably is the only way to address this sort of toxification of our industrial food system. And it just caught fire in my brain. And I was like, okay, we're going to do that. So we bought this farm and we started farming. And it just felt like we needed to link up with the community at large to do this together. You know, mm-hmm. food security has been on everyone's lips lately due to
Indeed.
Uncontrollable global events and things. So we wanted to be part of that. We want to be part of the solution. Mm-hmm. So we hooked up with Jade and Isabel, and we started talking about how we can be part of the solution to this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, beyond any sort of like calamitous thinking, it's just a marvelous way to live. Mm-hmm. You just feel so darn good.
You get up in the morning, you don't have to breathe exhaust fumes from vehicles.
You know it. Yeah, we lived on First Avenue in Vancouver, so we have been breathing fumes for a long time.
Yes, well, you'll clean your lungs out when you come in this part of the world.
Yes.
Now, Jade, you're the farmer with decades of experience in farming in the group. You grew up in Kamloops. Your father you described as a hunter-gatherer, somebody who was deeply embedded in food sort of sovereignty, if you like, acquiring food from local areas. And a healthy way to live was something that was impressed upon you. And then you farmed for a number of years in the Kootenays, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And also became engaged in farming processes that I think could be generally called progressive, things like biodynamic farm and permaculture. What was it that led all that led to Fries as a group in this part of the world?
Okay, good. Thank you. And again, just wonderful to be here having this conversation with you. Fries arose out of post-COVID concerns for food supplies and food security. And there's a lot of different definitions for food security. And the way we're defining it is the ability for a local community to have all of their own food or up to 80% of their own food grown around them. So no long supply chains. And that would include the ability to grow that food, inputs on the soil and whatnot. So it was initially this society was a conversation that was happening in our North Shuswap community with the Chamber of Commerce, the local RDCK rep, and others concerned from the community. And we knew that we wanted to support especially new farmers. And as the basis of a food system, we're going to need to increase the amount of food being grown. And there's major challenges to people who want to get into the food growing game. And that would include land access, equipment is expensive, gaining knowledge, and also housing. So we knew we needed a society that would have a bank account and that we could apply for grants for, and to move forward in that vision of actually addressing the root concerns with building a food system.
I'm going to remind listeners again that we're speaking with Jade and Isabel Shaman and Kwaka Nguyen and Amelia Jensen, the founding members of Fries, Food Resources, Infrastructure, and Education in the Shuswap. Now, there are two parts to the acronym Fries, Food Resources, Infrastructure, and Education. So I thought we could maybe break this down a little bit and talk about one and then the other. Now, the centralized food system we have now is vulnerable. It's not as vulnerable as a distributive food system where food is grown a little bit everywhere, all over the place by everybody. Now, Kwok, you worked with BC Hydro, and you were involved specifically with their emergency response management team, and you started to become very aware during a number of extreme weather events and other situations of the fragility of that system. And in addition to that, you'd had another impulse in you because your own father, who was working as a landscaper, developed unexpectedly lung cancer. And so there were these forces that told you that the system, the way it's structured, isn't working well. What did that do in your thinking about what you're doing now?
Yeah, in my time working there, there would be like maybe a severe windstorm or severe event once every 2 years, about 15 years ago. And we started to get to the stage where we were, in my last few years there, we're going from one disaster to the next, right? We go from a severe...
Almost immediately.
Yeah, a storm season gets you right into a flood season, and then into
drought.
Wildfires and stuff. So I think for myself and a lot of the people who work the front lines, it wears you down, right? And you start to see that, oh, okay, we're going to run out of steam here if we don't actually start to address some of the root issues. Mm. And so a root issue that started to creep up was the foods that we're eating, and not only the way that we're growing it, but, you know, the what we're putting on it before it we eat it. So for my father, my parents have always been entrepreneurs, whereas for myself, I sat in an office and got soft.
Somebody else did the entrepreneurial
stuff. Yeah, mm. Yeah. So I didn't have as much appreciation for it as I do now. for my father, he unexpectedly developed lung cancer in his 50s. And it was a surprise because he had given up smoking as soon as grandkids came along, and it had been like, you know, a good solid 20 years or so. Mm. But he did work a lot with Roundup and other glyphosate-containing mm-hmm. products. Mm-hmm. And so for within our family, it was kind of the red flag that came up. We were like trying to figure out what was happening. And so just diving into the world of our food system itself and the centralization of our power system as an example.
Right.
The problem with centralized systems is that while you can get a lot of information out of them and you can control them centrally, they don't handle well to any sorts of shocks that happen.
Yeah, disruptions are really disrupting.
Yes, exactly. And of course, you know, something is going to happen. It'd be nice to live in a world where things don't get disrupted, but...
Now, Jade, as a farmer, face-to-face with the issues that Kwok was describing in sort of systemic terms... You also saw the practical side that made farming a challenge, and you enumerated those: having access to land, having access to the equipment you need, and then being able to make a living. I mean, literally being able to make a living. But you'd also, in your farming career, branched into forms of farming, ways of farming that are good to the land. And that's very much part of the work that is involved, the practical work, having enough money in the bank that you can continue farming, having the right tools, and if they break down, being able to afford to fix them, and all these kinds of things. How did that influence your thinking when you were thinking of what the system needs, what needs to be changed in the system?
Right. One of the things that drew me into farming in the first place was the diversity of knowledge that you need to know. So it's very interesting. It's never boring. You go from studying the sky for weather conditions to studying the soil for what's in there. And that was half the reason initially why I got into farming was the just the unending learning experience, which for me is just, I just love that. I love learning things all the time. I'm still learning things every day. And
Mother Nature's a good teacher. She never lets you down.
That's right.
Something new and you didn't know.
So one of the things that happened with me as a landless farmer, which I was for most of my farming career, is I moved around a lot as well from farm to farm. And so every farm had its own systems. So with the biodynamics, I just happened to end up on Lofsted Farm in Kaslo, where it was a biodynamic farm. So for 2 years, I was immersed in biodynamics and so on. So I was exposed to a lot of different people with extremely experienced farmers with diverse backgrounds who had different ideas on how to do things. And you get to see the commonalities in all of that. But you also understand how important healthy soil is, healthy food is for people.
You would also have seen how much conventional agriculture takes place in our part of the world. It's chemical-based, it's heavy machinery-focused, it's large monocultural crops. You didn't go in that direction. Mm. What was the reason that you didn't, that you said, oh, that's not how I want to grow food?
Right. So my initial exposure to hands-on farming on a producing farm that was supplying its community happened to be an organic farm on one of the Gulf Islands in BC. And so my education started there. But it doesn't take, you know, my family grew up, my mom was grew up on a farm. So I was on my grandfather's farm a number of times. And so he was a conventional farmer with chemicals and whatnot. It's not hard to observe the detrimental effects, not only on the land and soil, but on the people using those chemicals. And realizing also that those small farms were highly productive and could keep going. And so that was an important part. So my education, you know, continued with organics the whole way. I've never farmed anything but organics.
And so you're definitely part of the coming generation by being that.
And of course, when you're in the organic community, you can't help. We all know what the problems are with the conventional way of growing food.
Yeah.
The myriad of problems.
And you can't go back. Once you've turned that corner, you just can't go back.
No.
Emilia, as you said earlier, I love food. And you grew up with growing food and gardens and foraging, interestingly, and became connected to indigenous practices. You got to know, you read repeatedly, if I understand correctly, Food Plants of British Columbia Indians, Interior Peoples by Nancy Turner. We wouldn't have a title with Indians in it anymore. We'd have Indigenous, but it's the same first letter, so you can get away with it. But you were drawn to their food ways and the fact that they derive their food from natural systems, and they also have shared meals and community as part of what they do as well. Do you want to talk about how that's shaped your welcoming this new kind of organization?
Certainly. Yeah, as a child growing up in Kelowna on this little hobby farm, we were surrounded by a lot of natural spaces, undeveloped hills and, you know, the ponderosa pine and bunch grass ecosystem, and have great memories of wandering around in those hills with my dad. And it was kind of our thing. He would point out plants and tell me what they were. And that really just like sparked my imagination. Just like imagining, like I can find food all over in these hills. It was kind of like just like a very captivating project as a kid.
And a very indigenous perspective. Whether you were thinking of it that way, that's what indigenous people, they say, there's my garden. There's
well,
my
I food. Can't remember how I learned about it, but somebody had turned me on to the fact that indigenous folks, that's the way they had been living forever and ever. And so I personally like requested this book as a birthday gift, and I was given it happily. And I had that thing memorized. I still own it, but it's like falling apart. And it was one of the best gifts I've ever received. Anyway, so it went from there to learning about how they, you know, used resources from the land. They didn't think of them as resources. Yeah. It was sort of more of like a harmonious living, right?
Give and take. And gifts.
Gifts and reciprocity. And just such a beautiful way of organizing your life. It requires a lot of labor as far as like paying attention to where things are. And I love that about it too. It trains your attention.
It's very empirical knowledge based. It's knowledge of what is, as opposed to some kind of silly theory that you made up.
Exactly. It's not abstract. It's so real. It's tangible. You put your hands on those things. You remember where that patch was growing last year. So you go revisit it. And then taking those things, and often they needed to be processed. So maybe you're putting bulbs in a pit with coals and roasting those. And that was like next level, figuring out how to do all of those things. Because wild foods, they tend to grow in small amounts, right?
They tend to grow in small amounts here, there, and everywhere, but not everywhere.
That's right.
That's sort of an entree into Isabel's role right now, which is bringing the next generation into the world and taking all of these new ideas, which are really old, old, old ideas, and bringing them back. And you have, in a way, what one might consider the most important task of all, which is bringing the next people who come onto this planet into a world where we've prepared the way. What's that like for you in terms of guiding your own involvement with Fries and with changing things in the world?
It's huge. It's everything. Seriously, like Fries is, we're basically tackling the first level of creating a regional food system in the shoe shop, right? So growing all the food that the shoe shop needs, that the shoe shop eats, right? So having a child just... having a child makes you think of the next generation, and this project is thinking of the next generation. So it's just in alignment with what you do as a mother anyways.
Sure. Of your commitments, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I plant my garden every year. You know, we plant our fields every year. and we have this vision, but then that having a child is just a longer term vision, mm-hmm. that he would take that on afterwards, and we would make this path easier for him now, mm-hmm. with our work with Fry's.
And everything you grow, you can think of Abel, your son, eating.
Oh yeah, he loves it.
He loves
it. I think there's no more joy in my heart than when we're in the garden and Abel is just picking at everything, eating everything he knows he can eat.
I grew up in Vancouver and we had gardens, and my father was farming organically when all the neighbors were going over to the pesticide revolution, it was considered to be in the 50s, which is a revelation about my chronology. But it was something that I remember doing, you know, eating peas right off the vine, eating raspberries off the bush.
Yeah.
It's knowing that it's all safe. And if it's safe for a child, it's got to be safe for everybody.
Well, that's interesting because he brings his friends in his garden, right? And then he'll go, hey, look at this. You can eat this one. And then the kids are like, really? Are you sure I can eat this? And then they look at their parents, and their parents, sometimes I get parents telling me to ask my son to stop telling them that he can eat that, because then they might confuse the plants or something. But kids are very, very perceptive, and he can see, oh, this one has three leaves, and he can see the shape of the plant and really tune into this. I know this is a pea, and you know.
Yeah. Out of the mouths of little children come great truths. The role of Fry's, as I was listening to you when you were talking before and thinking about it, is almost like an antidote. If you want to, I'm a physician, so in medical terms, it's like a treatment for a disease. And the disease in this case is a way of growing food that has got serious infirmities, serious health issues. And in a way, rebuilding the system is kind of like reconstructive surgery, hopefully without anesthetic or without pain and without a lot of blood loss. And let's talk about the tools and infrastructure thing. Jade, in particular, because you're so experienced with this area, what kinds of tools and what kinds of infrastructure does a farmer need to make it easier to facilitate farming work?
All right, so every farmer obviously would have your basic equipment like a tractor and a plow and different types of harrows.
And I would go back and say even some have horses, which they use for farming, but I won't introduce that.
You know, it's actually, we just had a conversation this morning about the value of horses. And I know Vince McIntyre in the Kootenays was a horse farmer, and he was close to me when I was farming out there at one point, and it was wonderful to watch him produce. And he would bring masses of potatoes to market all the time. So it can be done.
Yes.
And so the infrastructure that, depending on what a farmer's growing, what they need. And in our case right now, we're focusing on potatoes. So on top of just the basic equipment that you would use to stir the soil and get it conditioned, you would need a potato planter. You would need a piece of equipment to weed those potatoes during the season, and you would need a harvester. So there's specialized equipment.
Just remind listeners once again that our guests in the studio today are Jade and Isabel Shaman and Kwakan Nguyen, Amelia and Amelia Jensen. They are the founding members of Fry's, Food Resources, Infrastructure and Education in the Shoe Swap. So growing potatoes requires certain kinds of implements and machinery. What else do farmers use widely that are valuable things for them to have on hand or have access to?
To have access to irrigation equipment. So that's a big one. And there's various different ways to approach that. Our approach has been surface lines that we just drain in the wintertime when winter comes and roll up in occasion. So irrigation equipment.
Specifically irrigation equipment to conserve water. Because that's becoming more and more of an issue these days as there are droughts and there are water deficiency seasons. Mm-hmm. more often than used to be.
So now irrigation is an interesting topic, and we could have a whole show on that because I've gone through...
Well, we'll have you back for an irrigation show.
Because, you know, okay, so my personal philosophy has always been look at how the plants were created to grow, like what they thrive in, and that includes the animals. So when we had cows, we fed them what cows were meant to eat, grass, mm-hmm. and chickens were meant to eat, you know, grains and bugs, and so on, right? So... For me, I've gone through the process of irrigation with drip feed and underground and all kinds of all the different systems. I've worked with it. And at this point, we do overhead irrigation because here in BC, we actually have a lot of water. And what I like to see, what we like to see is the whole gardening area is lush because that's more like it should be.
Not so just the plants.
Not
we want
just
yeah, everything.
Not just the plant. And in our vegetable garden that we have just for ourselves, you know, it's very lush. There's things growing everywhere.
You have to climb over
That's
the
right.
hardy native perennials to get to the food yes. plants.
No,
that you
there's
want.
Pathways. I make sure there's pathways.
Well done, Isabel.
That are weed whacked.
So and we are so what we're actually doing is building soil throughout the entire garden. So one of the big things that I don't like about specific irrigation that's dripped right at the base of a plant. Plant is that beside it and away from it, it's a drought. So now the soil is not being handled as well, right? So we like a lush green garden. And now I would grow, I've farmed actually in New Mexico where water was a serious issue. So now down there, that's where I really had more drip experience. And of course, it makes sense there.
For sure.
But, you know, one of the things like what Amelia was talking about, indigenous ways, is natural peoples really take everything into consideration.
Yes.
So you have to look at, even within BC, in different regions, there's differences. Even the next door farm might have different conditions. So
BC is a hopeless agglomeration of different micro ecosystems.
Yes.
It's a wonderful
yes.
challenge mm-hmm. to people farming, I have to
yes.
say. Where do we live right now?
That's right.
Yeah.
And so interesting about that is I just took an indigenous training session a few days ago, and it pointed out how many different groups of people lived here and how many different languages were spoken. So that speaks to that each farm, even beside itself, there's so many different conditions. So.
Yeah.
So when I talk about overhead watering, it's in the context of where we are, where we have unlimited water, basically. So you keep that in mind when we discuss different techniques here, because we are definitely always aware of our entire ecosystem and feeding the ecosystem as best we can.
I really avoid using the word weeds and try to talk about hardy native perennials all the time, because it really is actually what they are, as opposed to our fantasies about goodness and badness. Now, Kwok, your orientation is around finance, and that's what you've worked at for a quarter century. Looking at farmers and financial resources for farmers, what kind of things do you see Fry's trying to find for farmers to make their life easier?
Yeah, when you were speaking earlier about trying to automate some of the processes, right, the biggest challenges that we see are actually getting enough people to grow the food as the first and foundational step. So according to Stats Canada's numbers, we lose something like $3.5 billion of food that's unpicked every year.
Yes.
Right? We are somewhere between the 35th to the 38th largest population, so we're small. But most people don't know that we're also the sixth largest importer of food. Mm. Number five behind us is the EU. And so we have a system to grow food, but we're struggling with getting the food out of the ground. And so for us, starting with potatoes as the first primary crop and being able to use some automation to get the food out of the ground, we're trying to address like a choke point in the system there.
And finances, farmers need money to farm. Mm-hmm. A lot of farmers who've been on the show talk about how difficult it is getting a living financial stability out of the work they do. Do you, as you're obviously you play a role in Fry's of as the financial advisor,
officially treasurer. Yeah,
yeah.
There's no treasure, but I get to be the treasurer.
what specific tools, like things like grants or other kinds of support systems, are available to farmers that you're aware of?
Yeah, so I this is a kind of us stepping into a new area when it comes to the whole grant system. We focused more at this point for Amelia and myself was looking at the question of, you know, when you're running a farm operation, you could run one for that's like you're outputting $500,000 in expenses, if not more, you know, and then you're trying to make $550,000 in income, right? But if you could farm in a way where you're not, you don't have to bring in inputs every year, you don't have to spray your crops, you've got a soil, you know, your focus is on the health of the soil that grows you nutritious food and brings you abundance each year. We want to do farming in a way that where there's not a giant overhead to come in. And this is where Fry's is trying to help out new people who want to break ground is that, you know, you've got a team of people here, varying levels of experience, but lots of enthusiasm and, you know, and equipment to loan and help farmers get started.
Speaking of enthusiasm, Amelia, you kind of radiate a certain amount of enthusiasm. And obviously that's part of what drew you into Fry's, but also moving here and establishing a farm. How important is that? In other words, people feeling that what they're doing is the right thing. You must have met, I would presume, an increasing number of people who share your enthusiasm for growing food in a healthy manner for people so they can have healthy teeth, which you know all about. How important do you think that is in terms of moving this whole kind of project forward?
Well, I'm glad that you can pick up on my enthusiasm because it is real. I'm very thrilled to be doing this. Yeah. There's a certain amount of invigoration that comes from new ventures. I'm sure you know. Lots of new experiences feels very enlivening. As far as like the passion or the feeling of rightness to carry us forward through this work, I would say sometimes that can come. You might not feel it at the beginning. Maybe it's more of like a logical or a theoretical knowing that this is the thing to be doing. And then you start and then you like it and you have some successes and then it starts to snowball, right? Especially if you can be doing it with others in community, feels much more doable, feels more like you can be mentored a bit so it doesn't feel overwhelmingly new in every category. So there's certain organizations that are bringing people together already in that way. ShoeSwap Food Action Society, which I know you've interviewed Melanie Bennett from there.
Many times.
Whole organization is amazing to bring people together and a mentoring sort of atmosphere.
We actually met at one of the SFAS meetings, right?
Yes,
so that's
indeed.
What kind of brought us together and, you know, the root of this project.
And you'll be pleased to know that Melanie used to be a wedding planner.
Really?
Yes, she is.
Well, that explains a lot. She's a very good event planner.
She's an organizer, indeed. Jade, specifically, how will Fry's get equipment to farmers, or how will it make it possible for farmers to get equipment? What's the plan?
Right. The plan is to do it. And, you know, I meant to bring this poem in by Goethe, and the poem, I used to have it in a plaque when Isabel and I first met. And basically it says, when you know something needs to be done and it's the right thing to do, just start taking the first steps and things will start to fall into place. Like, you know, literally.
The one where they say boldness has genius, power, and magic to it. Yes.
So we, you know, there are grants available out there, but the truth is, as farmers, I don't have the time to write grants. And it's just paperwork is just not something that I want to do very much of or have time to do. So, and often, ironically, the grants are, the deadlines are right during the busiest farming season. Sure. So
what would be better than that? Bringing them the equipment, say we're coming on Thursday with a potato seeder or something like that, or a harrow, or how do you visualize the actual implementation of this transfer of equipment or this loaning or this renting?
Right. So right now we're financing this pretty much with ourselves, our own money, right? And so we're creating a model that other farmers, especially new and inexperienced farmers, could easily follow. Potatoes are a relatively easy crop to learn.
Sure.
And our expectations would be that someone who wants to get in would have some basic equipment like a tractor and some other basic stuff. And then we'll work out, depending on who it is, if they're a very responsible, mechanically minded, then I would have no problem just passing equipment over for them to use. If they have less mechanical ability or really really struggling with learning that side of things, then I might operate that specialized equipment myself until I'm sure that they can do it safely and, mm-hmm. and without breaking machinery too much. Mm-hmm. Although I still break machinery myself. That's
or machinery just breaks.
Yes.
When you least expect it.
Yeah. So, and no, the truth is every farmer probably spends half their time just fixing equipment. So, and again, we're just kind of moving forward organically as we mm-hmm. figure this out. But mm-hmm. what we all really know is this is the way forward.
Yes, indeed.
Small scale, clean food.
Local.
We just need to start. So we're just taking those first steps and we're kind of figuring a lot of stuff out together and as we go along.
Well, I don't think you guys have missed a step in the conversation so far. It all sounds pretty good stuff. Isabel, you're taking these ideas, these concepts, and bringing them into the life of your son, using that as a motivation. There are many other motivations, mm-hmm. but translating healthy, growing healthy food, healthy eating, what's that like to see it reflected in Abel's remarks or his behavior? What is that like?
Abel is very healthy. He has been sick maybe 3 times, I think, in his whole life. He's never seen a doctor.
Except for me today.
Yeah,
all right, which is social.
Yeah, well,
you don't have to convince him to eat his vegetables.
No. Yeah, he's a totally... Maybe what would be the most interesting thing to say about, you know, a kid living on an organic farm and eating... Basically, like all winter, I do not buy vegetables. We just eat our own roots that we are saving in our root cellar and stuff. So... It would be about this kid now in time. You know, all his other friends are not living like that necessarily. You know, we're part of a homeschool group and many of the kids don't have gardens and they eat, you know, wrapped up food a lot. So, but Abel has this perception that he knows we're different than them. You know, like he's 5 and he's like, I know I don't eat the same things as you guys, you know, and that's interesting. But so to see his health and to see that he's a very busy guy and it's a blessing, you know, like so busy for a mom, you know, that, but to always be reminded that it's because he's healthy and we're making sure that he's, you know,
he's got the tools
and
to
he's
do
learning
with.
So he's learning all of what we're doing, right? He hangs out when we have our meetings, you know, our board meetings, we make it very very easygoing, and Abel is always there, so he knows what we're up to. He knows, you know, he loves being on the tractor too.
every culture has always had as its primary mode of learning the modeling and mentorship. It's never been, and that parents modeling children is one very clear-cut example of that. But it's interesting the phrase we have, don't do as I do, do as I say, which is a pathetic attempt by parents to try and say, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but I told you that it's not the thing you should be doing. Never
definitely
happens.
Definitely don't do that.
I remind listeners once again that we're welcoming into the studio Jade and Isabel Shaman and Kwok and Nguyen and Amelia Jensen. And they are the founding members of FRIES, Food Resources, Infrastructure, and Education in the Shuswap. Now, one of the things that is also part of this exercise is to pass on information, to share knowledge. And I notice that seminars and workshops and that kind of thing, obviously on the land would be the place to hold them. What kind of plans are there? Anybody can answer, but Jade, I expect, has a lot to say about it.
In terms of education, we do have an article that we publish with each kicker article at the moment, and our plans is to pass on as much information as possible. We haven't done much in that area at this point, other than watching Abel soak up everything that he learns. But I will say that. The you know, by far the best way to learn is always with people who know what they're doing and hands-on experience. And I think it's the most fun way to learn as well. And that human-to-human contact. And that's part of what we're doing is just really connecting people to people and people to their land and people to their food. And nothing can take the place of that experience of working with each other. It's just been amazing.
Yeah, and I imagine we'll be working quite closely with new farmers that are brought on to mentor them. And, you know, it's not going to be a matter of them needing to apply to use the equipment. It's like we'll be working with them. We'll know when they need to use the equipment, and we'll make sure they know how to use it, or we'll teach them to use it.
And getting the word out, too, is an important part of what you're doing so that people know you're there. I mean, hopefully there'll be some listeners today who will be dialing up a number and calling you right away and say, we want to be part of this, or
yes,
we need some tools.
Great. Put them in our direction.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So if people do come to you and they do ask for help, what kind of... The reason I'm asking this is because this mentoring process is critically, and it's central to all learning, no matter what people say. In medicine, we say, watch one, do one, teach one. Now, it's a little bit abbreviated, but it's the same idea. If you see somebody doing something and then you do it yourself with them guiding you, then you can often do it quite well. So do you have a sense of that kind of trajectory being part of what you're doing?
Right. So one of the things that we've decided on is to actually be doing stuff and succeeding at it. So one of the challenges to get new farmers in is to show them that they can actually pay the bills with what they're growing. Mm-hmm. And so the potato crop, again, going back to that, is something that we are working that one out so that we can say to a new farmer, look, just on this 2 or 3 acres, if you get that sod turned over, you can make X amount of dollars. Now, there's a big, you know, it's a ballpark figure because every field grows different amounts. Right. But that is the approach, is to be able to actually show them it's a viable business. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful way to live as well.
Have you been connecting with groups like, say, Organics BC or the Young Agrarians? Because they are groups that are already focused on the kinds of issues that you're trying to bring forward. Have any of you had any contacts with them?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, like, we are maybe adding something different here, is that by actually, like, running the experiment and just doing it, and then taking the time to reflect, and, you know, we're recording what we're doing videos, we're doing, and we'll get a website up and to help people and connect. But we also don't want to replicate what other groups are doing really well, right? Mm-hmm. Connecting young farmers with older farmers and stuff like that too. Sure. So we're just focused on the doing part first, and then reaching out to other groups as we go.
There's something about credibility in the farming community. If you say, this is what you should do, and somebody says, well, have you ever done it? Well, no, but I read a book about it. It doesn't cut it. Doesn't cut it.
Yeah, that's kind of Amelia and I right now. And so, you know, it's been kind of a fun learning experience for us. We have made some hilarious mistakes, which we'll write and post about.
Yes, but beginner's mind is the mind you need to cultivate in order to not be defeated by your errors, right? You're like, okay, good. We learned that lesson really well.
I want to add something educational that I'm doing personally because I have this heart, but also we could say that Fry's is running this, but I'm personally taking on a dozen kids will have, you know, a spot in my garden this year and plant their own little plots. And I feel like that is a big part of education. I'm planning the lesson for them to plant their little garden plots, mm-hmm. and then they'll come and then they'll seed their stuff, take care of it until we can transplant it. And that really is a big part of what I'm doing, yeah.
We've also had some opportunities we've been asked to run workshops and speak in the community as well at different events and things. So we have a chance to, like, teach what we know. I mean, Kwok made a comment about us, our learning being mostly theoretical, and we have read 1,000 books about it. But we've got 4 years of growing under our belt now, so I feel like we've got something to share, if not only what not to do.
Jade, you had some comment.
Well, I've had a lot of fun over the years. One of the things about farmers, and of course I'm part of that group, is that we're really stubborn. And I've had a lot of fun over the years doing things that other farmers told me I couldn't possibly do. And I've had other farmers finally come out to my field and look at what I'm actually doing, because they could refuse to believe that I'm using
so
the techniques.
So these would be farmers who are doing things conventionally.
Nope, these are organic farmers.
Oh, really?
So, for instance, in Winlaw one year when I was farming there, it was a cold, damp year, and onions don't tend to do well. But my onions were superb, and they were big, and everyone was having trouble bringing onions. Now, my onions were growing in raised, mulched beds full of weeds. Because, again, like, I agree, weeds are not really weeds. That's a bad word to put on them. They're actually, some of them, super nutritious plants. I only remove other plants from my crops if they interfere with it, or under when the other my crops are very young, I take them out. But sure. I've brought farmers that year to my onion patch, and from 50 feet away, they would look and say, "Where's the onions?" But then when you got up close, well, there was row upon row right next to each other, big, beautiful onions. And so even with organic, within the organic community, we teach each other stuff all the time. And in that case there, the soil was just being treated so well, and it was so healthy, and those onions, they did very well.
They like, that's companion planting without having to plant.
Exactly.
They just grow. So two words came up when I was sort of thinking about what we talk about today. One is love. A doctor talking about love. You don't hear it every day, but on this channel.
Dr. Love.
And the other thing is courage. And you've kind of made some references to it, trying things, stepping into a space that you're not familiar with. Because we're living in the middle of a profoundly transformational time for the human race. We're deciding whether we want to make a world that our children can live in successfully, or we're going to be the last generation that had everything we thought and unfortunately didn't leave anything for next round. Amelia, you talked about loving having your hands in the dirt. Did you have to go through from the dental hygienist role to the farmer's role with a little bit of a qualm at first? Because it's opposite ends of the spectrum.
You would expect so, but that was not the case with me. Quack always makes fun of me and calls me a dirty little farm kid because I take
which
so well.
Which is a compliment.
It is a compliment now, yes. But when Quack and I started dating, he was very focused on cleanliness and liked everything to be very sterile.
And he thought you were going to be the cleanest person in town because you're a dental hygienist.
Yes, oh, I know. Disinfecting every surface.
No plaque.
Anyway, so I do love to have my hands in the dirt, and it was not a hard transition. And I actually had a bit of time between when I stopped practicing clinically. I had to leave my profession due to an injury, actually. Mm. So there was a time between when I stopped working, was forced to stop working, and when we moved here, that I was quite unwell. My back felt like it was broken, as my niece would say. Mm. And so I had a lot of time to think and to study and to really decide next steps.
As a physician, I can affirm that injuries or illnesses are often transition points in people's lives. We often look at them negatively, just as we look at you know, something you didn't expect to happen that didn't work well in your life or your business as tragedies, but actually they are motivational points where you say, okay, it's time for me to do something different, or Mother Nature or my own body has said, go in a different direction. And it's a huge opportunity often. And
that's the
Chinese pictogram that says, you know, opportunity is, or tragedy is opportunity plus trouble. Anyway, Jade, you know, having been immersed in just loosely calling a progressive or healthier farming practices, how does this life feel like to you now? You've been doing it for years, but in addition to just getting knowledgeable, you also have a sentiment about it, a sentiment that this is a good thing or a right thing to be doing. How's that for you?
Right. So, yeah, at this point when there's more and more awareness of not only the value of having a local food system, but to us personally, but also the value of that to the environment and to our civilization, quite frankly, it doesn't feel any better because it always felt good from the beginning. When you're doing something that resonates and you know is good for yourself in the environment, it always feels good. But it actually puts more of a responsibility when you do have experience to figure out ways to share that experience. And I would go back to the word you mentioned earlier, courage. And I saw that courage in Quack and Amelia to be city people, let's call them that, to move out and to know that the way forward is this farming, you know, local organic movement, and to have that courage to actually take it on with no prior experience almost, right? Now, Amelia does have a little background, mm-hmm. but as her adult life, she didn't, right? And And that courage is something that more of us could tap into because it feels really good. And being uncomfortable is okay. And actually, it's stimulating for growth and health in a lot of ways. And I think that that courage is something that, that we see in others and are encouraging to bring out in people to just take the step, go for it. It's a lot of fun.
Isabel, you are working with the next generation. What do you want, in 25 words or less, because we're getting close to the end of the show, what do you want for Abel when he grows up in terms of the world of food and the world of healthy living?
I want him to have a community focused on food and each other and support each other and have a healthy life like that. Yeah, that's what I want for my son.
Oh, I'm just sitting here kind of floating along on all this lovely conversation. I want to thank Jade and Isabel and Kwok and Amelia, who's out keeping an eye on Abel right now. I want to thank you all for coming in today and for Abel being here as well, because he's a visible reminder of why we're even having this conversation.
Absolutely.
And I want to thank you all for the work you're doing and the work you're trying to do and the work that you're aiming to do in the future, because this is a process in development. It's been a real treat to have you on this studio. Thank you all for coming today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. You've been a generous host. We've been happy to be here.